Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
Shaking up a beloved dish and creating something outside the box can be risky business, but that's just what food podcaster Dan Pashman did. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
What's cooking is perhaps the biggest thing in pasta since a noodle took to sauce.
That was back in 2021 when the pasta-shaped cascatelli hit the market. It was created by food lover and host of the Sporkful podcast, Dan Pashman. And his mission was for it to hold the most sauce and have the best chew. Well, Pashman is continuing to push the culinary envelope. He's written his first cookbook all about sauces.
I will not put any tomato sauce recipes in my cookbook unless they're really different from anything I've had before. For any dish where you just need a basic tomato sauce, I'm going to tell people to use jarred sauces. There's so many good ones out there. Why do you need to make one from scratch?
Wait, what? No tomato sauce? That's bold. Instead, he focuses on delicious mashups, textures galore, adding pasta to unexpected places, and bringing old Italian recipes to life. Anything's Possible, 81 inventive pasta recipes for saucy people, is out next week. And I checked in with author Dan Pashman to learn what he found is possible with pasta. Here's Dan.
Well, when cascatelli came out, you know, like you said, it went viral, which was, of course, incredibly exciting and very gratifying. You know, but people were sending me pictures from all over the country and all over the world of what they're eating with the cascatelli. And it was a little bit sad because, like, 3/4 of what I was seeing was tomato sauce, meat sauce, mac and cheese. I mean, a few party animals might have made pesto. All those things are fine, but I just feel like cascatelli aside, there's so many more things we can and should be putting on our pastas. And so I said, I'm going to set out and try to write a cookbook to help open people's minds about all the possibilities out there.
But what do you got against tomato sauce, though? I mean, this goes against everything I've ever known, Dan.
I mean, I'm not against tomato sauce. We still eat plenty of it in my house, Sasha, as you probably do in yours.
Yes.
It's just only one thing,
you
know? And I'll be honest, I'm a little tired of it. I mean, I have kids, and it's just such a quick and easy throw the pasta in the water, open up a jar, and that's fine. But so that's why, you know, in my cookbook, instead of having recipes of how to make tomato sauce from scratch, I have a jarred tomato sauce decision tree. So that it tells you, you take a jar of sauce, and then I give you all these different decisions you can make to add to the jar, doctor the jar, to make it a little bit new and different. But beyond that, I just feel like I realized that I was in a bit of a pasta sauce rut, perhaps without even knowing it. And working on this book helped to break me out of it.
Yeah. So in your view, what makes good pasta? And what's your metric for both the noodle itself and the finished dish?
Right. So in terms of a good pasta itself, I mean, so in terms of a good shape, I have these three criteria that I've come up with. One is called forkability. How easy is it to get the shape on your fork and keep it there? Then there's sauceability. How well does sauce adhere to the shape? And then, of course, tooth sinkability, which is how satisfying is it to sink your teeth into it? I think that a great shape should be able to do all three of these things. And most of the shapes out there only do one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of a sauce, I mean, look, there are a lot of great sauces out there. Life is too short for only one pasta shape or only one pasta sauce.
Right, I agree.
I do put a lot of thought in the book into how to pair the shape with the sauce. And I think there's an awful lot of sort of Italian folklore and tradition tied up in, like, you know, this shape and this sauce must be the only, like, there's only one sauce for this shape and only one shape for this sauce. And I think that's just sort of a little tied up in mythology and tradition. I think there are, you know, a great shape will go with a range of sauces and a great sauce can go with a range of shapes. But that doesn't mean they all go with all of them.
That is true. And I've been expanding with my shapes lately as well. Good. You've got a chapter in the book that's just all about texture and We loved to see that here on Team Reset. When you think back, Dan, do you know the moment or the dish that affirmed for you how important multiple textures is in a bite?
I've always been a huge texture eater. We did an episode of the Sporkful podcast years ago where I went to Philadelphia and I interviewed researchers at the Monell Chemical Senses Center.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the researchers there, it was this episode where I ran all around Philadelphia grabbing all the classic foods of Philly, the cheesesteak, the scrapple, the pork sandwich with the broccoli rub. And I brought it to this research center and said, let's eat these things. And I want you to tell me why these things are so good to people.
Mm-hmm.
And the most striking thing that I learned from that experience was the idea of something called dynamic contrast. Dynamic contrast is a term sensory scientists use to describe a bite of food that brings together multiple textures.
Uh-huh.
Now, you may not know that term, Sasha, but I'll bet you love it. You love dynamic contrast, as do most people. You think about, think about a chocolate bar, a great chocolate bar. Your teeth pierce through the sort of hard chocolate exterior,
mm-hmm.
and usually you're going to sink into something that's a little bit chewy.
Like a nut.
Gooey, right, or caramel. And, mm-hmm. and then there's going to be something crispy inside, or a different kind of crunch. There'll be a nut or nougat. So you're going to get crispy, crunchy, chewy, gooey, all in the same bite, and that is dynamic contrast. And there are a lot of Italian pasta dishes that use dynamic contrast and bring together different textures. It's, of course, widely used across an array of Asian noodle and rice dishes.
Yeah.
And yet I feel like most of the pasta dishes that are eaten in America don't bring together very many textures. It's sort of like a monotextural sauce,
yeah.
and, you know, glopped on top of the pasta. And so I wanted to just really highlight, to do a whole chapter just of like, here's how we're going to bring together all different textures to enliven your pasta eating experience.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. I mean, this is totally unlike the way we do it here in America, totally unlike the way Italians do things, right?
There's not a whole lot of rules that I feel that strongly about, to be honest, Sasha.
Yeah.
I have a lot of opinions, but not so many rules.
So one of the pastas in the chapter on texture was super distinct to me, and it was the assassina. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Yeah, you pan fry the noodle. It gets charred in places. What does that taste like?
Oh, I mean, it's incredible. So it's called spaghetti all'assassina, which means assassin's spaghetti.
Ah.
It's a dish from Bari in the heel of the boot of Italy. It was only invented in 1960. It's relatively new. And as part of my research on this book, I actually went to Bari to the restaurant where it was invented. And yes, you take spaghetti, you cook it in a spicy tomato sauce, you cook it down and down until the sauce is effectively a paste.
Mm.
And then you keep pan frying it until the pasta is charred and crispy crunchy. It has incredible, you know, it's not uniformly crispy crunchy. It has crispy bits and crunchy bits and still chewy doughy bits. So you get that dynamic contrast. You get those different textures. And the taste is you get the spicy tomato sauce. You get all those textures. But the other thing you get is you get a very distinct flavor of toasted bread because the pasta has effectively been toasted. And that is really like a lovely little nice note in this spaghetti all'assassina that I didn't expect to experience when I went to eat it. I was so focused on the crunch, but it's something that I loved about it and worked very hard to make sure it was to be incorporated in my recipe that would be in the cookbook.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that. And now, as I said in the intro, Danny, I mean, you've got recipes in here for dishes that I wouldn't normally associate with pasta, right? Vegan dirty orzo instead of rice.
Yeah, and shout out to Chef Darnell Reed of Luella's Southern Kitchen in Chicago, one of my favorite restaurants in the country.
Yes,
which
mine
was
too.
The first. Darnell is phenomenal. I love his restaurant. I love everyone there. And I go there every time I'm in town in Chicago. And that was actually the first restaurant in America that put cascatelli on the menu.
Really?
And Darnell did a Cajun crawfish carbonara cascatelli that is just so luscious, so decadent. And he put it on his menu. When I started working this book, I reached out to him. I said, we got to get that recipe in the cookbook. So we worked together to adapt it for the cookbook. And I worked with him to do a couple of others for the cookbook. One is a shrimp and andouille sausage mac and cheese. It uses a lot of American cheese, which is phenomenal and the best melting cheese known to humankind. And the other is the one you mentioned, Sasha, this vegan dirty orzo. And so
yes.
It's done with, you know, a meat substitute, although you can use ground meat if you like. Orzo instead of rice, you got the Creole seasoning, you got the holy trinity of peppers and onions and all. And I mean, this was one of my wife's favorites. It's just, it hits every note
it's
that
so
you
layered.
Want from dirty rice.
Yeah.
Yes, but swapping in the orzo is a little different. It makes it a little bit doughier. Almost, I mean, as if it was even possible to make dirty rice more comforting. I'm not sure, but like if it is, this'll do it.
Yeah. You do a dal mixed with pasta.
Yeah, and this is something, so like, look, dal, right, dal with shells is something that I do in my own home. And a lot of these recipes, so, you know, I'm doing kimchi carbonara in here. I'm doing cacio e pepe with chili crisp. I'm doing shakshuka with shells.
Yes.
some of these things I sat down to say, like, what can I do that's different? But some of these things are just things that I sort of stumbled onto in my own kitchen. I think that as our country becomes more diverse and as our kitchens and our cuisine become more diverse, we're all cooking with a wider range of ingredients and different dishes. And so I cook dal, and I sometimes have leftover dal in the fridge right next to some leftover pasta.
Nice.
And I got to take a break from work and make lunch. And it's like, why don't I mix these two things together?
But have you encountered people who are like, what? And they just can't wrap their minds around you swapping out the starch for pasta?
Yeah, certainly, yes. For people who for whom it's not familiar,
yeah.
Yes. There are people who are surprised and hopefully excited as well.
Excited to try it?
Right, but I talked to the cookbook author Kushbu Shah about this mac and dal recipe, and she was saying, you know, a lot of Indian folks in diaspora are already doing this in their homes. And so I think this is just... this is how cuisine evolves oftentimes. It's not always some fancy chef who's decided to try to make something that's going to shock you. It's home cooks just experimenting and mashing up the flavors and ingredients that they have on hand.
Yeah. Now, were there some things that you tried with pasta that just didn't work?
There's a lot of Central and Eastern European sort of pasta noodle dishes that involve like cottage cheese and nuts and sometimes like cinnamon and sugar. It's like a sweet pasta dish, and I just couldn't quite get that to work. So that one I had to cut.
Yeah. You know, Dan, you are not a recipe creator by trade, right? No secret there, but tell us more about the method for making the book and how you actually worked with recipe creators.
Yeah, so I'm not a trained chef. I have no real culinary training whatsoever. I think I'm a pretty good home cook. And at the beginning of this process, honestly, I had a lot of imposter syndrome about it. I was like, you know, why does anyone want my recipes? Why should anyone listen to what I have to say? So the first thing that I did to address that was that I went out and assembled a sort of like an all-star team of recipe developers. These are professionals with culinary training who have the expertise to test a recipe 5, 6, 8 times to get the ingredients just right. So I might have an idea, like I think these things will go well together,
mm-hmm.
but then they would take that rough idea and turn it into a proper recipe. And then they would also come to me with ideas and we discuss back and forth. So it was a really great collaboration. And
I want to make sure folks understand, like, this is an intricate process, right? Because you even share the story in the book about testing the cavatelli with roasted artichokes and preserved lemons.
Yeah,
and it just shows, like, the process, it can be tedious, but it's so rewarding.
100%. And that's something that I wanted to do in this book and in the Sporkful podcast series that we're releasing now that accompanies the book, which is to pull the curtain back a little bit. Because I found when I first started working on this, a lot of friends of mine, even folks who buy a lot of cookbooks, don't really know how they're made and what goes into it. And I thought it would be interesting to let people in on that process a little bit. So, yeah, the cavatelli with roasted artichokes and preserved lemon, which became one of my favorite recipes in the book. It started off, I was reading through old Italian cookbooks, looking for inspiration. I found a recipe for a pasta dish with artichokes and lemon, and I love artichokes and lemon, so I said, that sounds good. Let's, you know, I chatted with my recipe developers. One of them said, what if we swap in preserved lemon, which is a North African and Middle Eastern ingredient that I love. It's saltier. It's very savory. It's got a strong lemon flavor. It just, I think, is more complex than just plain old lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to work on that. One of my recipe developers, Katie Laird, started working on it. And there was a lot of back and forth. At first, she was frying the artichokes, and I thought that was good, but then I had reservations. I wanted more artichokes, but I didn't want people to have to fry in batches. So it was just back and forth and back and forth to switch to roasted artichokes and get the proportions. And then, you know, you think it's done and you go away from it for a month and then you're craving it. So then I would go and cook it. And
just try it.
Like, well, I don't know. It might need another teaspoon of this. And so, you know, you're never 100%
sure. Oh, that's
sure
a lot.
You got it right. I will say, though, Sasha, like, as much as I had concerns going in about the merits of my own cookbook, at the end of the process, I came to see my lack of culinary training not as a weakness but as a strength. Because I feel like this book is for home cooks who may have a range of different skill levels and comfort levels in the kitchen. And I worked with the pros to make sure that the professional side of things was taken care of, but I was the stand-in for the reader. So sometimes they would send me a recipe and I'd say, I don't understand this instruction, or the recipe would come out poorly. And we analyze it, well, because this line was written with a sort of chef speak. And I would rewrite it to put it in terms that I, as an average home cook, can understand.
Yeah.
And so I hope that that will make the cookbook better and more accessible and ensure that people get great results.
Yeah, that collaboration was essential for sure. So this book comes out on Tuesday. And on Thursday, Dan, you've got a Chicago event. You're going to be with Joanne Lee Molinaro, who we know here on Reset. She's a great friend to the show. We also know her in the social media world as the Korean Vegan. That's going to be a live taping of your podcast, too, right?
That's right. Live taping. Joanne and I will be in conversation. Darnell Reed of Luella Southern Kitchen in Chicago will join us on stage for part of the time as well.
Nice.
So you'll get to see a live podcast taping, and then afterwards I'll be signing copies of Anything's Possible. So I think it's going to be a really fun event.
And we look forward to it. That is Dan Pashman, his book, Anything's Possible, 81 Inventive Pasta Recipes for Saucy People, is out next Tuesday wherever books are sold. So go check it out. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thank you, Sasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Linnea Dominic, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. To hear more conversations about the food around us, make sure to subscribe and head over to wbez.org/reset for a full archive of our interviews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again soon.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.